Today on Vox Talks Economics, why did US financial markets wobble when the pandemic hit, and how can we stop it happening again? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so hit that button marked subscribe and follow us on Instagram for clips and previews. In March 2020, we all assumed that COVID-19 would cause some reaction in US financial markets, but most observers were still surprised when they saw exactly what occurred. As investment-grade bonds plummeted, treasury yields climbed, rapid action by the Fed was needed to stabilize the economy. So what happened? Why? And what can we do to stop it happening again? That's the theme of a new report from the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy and the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, Anil Kashyap of the University of Chicago at CEPR, and Kate Judge of Columbia University are two of the authors, and they're both with me today. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, both of you.
Good to see you.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Kate, I'll come to you first. I remember in the financial crisis in 2008, we were 2 hours away from the ATMs shutting down. At least that was the story we were told afterwards. How close to the edge did the US financial system get in March 2020?
Close, probably not as close as we were in 2008. One of the biggest differences was, even though the shock was actually a greater shock and happened much more rapidly than anything we saw in 2007 and 2008, policymakers had a array of tools right at their disposal that they had developed over time in response to the last crisis, and they were very quick to deploy them. So we certainly saw a significant shock. We saw significant dysfunction. Things could have gone much worse than they did, but it was very aggressive action by policymakers, the Fed, Congress subsequently, that helped avoid a major financial catastrophe.
I mean, what did happen, though, Anil, was pretty weird. What happened in the bond markets to create those sort of counterintuitive price movements? We had a sort of flight from quality, didn't we?
Yeah, during the first phases of the coronavirus being detected, you saw kind of the normal thing. The stock market was cratering, volatility was rising, and people were rushing to buy treasuries and yields were falling. And then around the 9th of March, you saw this reversal where all of a sudden treasury yields started rising, which, as you say, is not typically what happens during stress. Usually people want to buy treasuries. What we know now is that a lot of people just needed cash, and it turned out they needed bank deposits, and they were selling treasuries to try to get cash that they could then use for other purposes. And it turned out our ability to handle all the volume of selling in the treasury market wasn't adequate, and the market became overwhelmed. Yields started to rise. They became much more volatile. Bid-ask spreads widened. And the market was in real trouble until the Fed stepped in.
There was also a problem, wasn't there, for non-bank lenders in the housing market. Was that just a consequence of what we just described?
It was that. It was also more. One of the big shifts that we have seen since 2008 is it's become a lot more costly for banks to be engaged in the housing market. So we've seen a massive growth in the role of non-banks in both originating and servicing loans. And those non-banks are subject to much thinner regulations. They really don't have the liquidity or the capital that they need to deal with a shock like this. So this is one of the areas where we got very fortunate because of the aggressive interactions, but there was real fragility that was on display in March and April and even into May of last year.
Like you say, strong activity to calm the markets. What happened?
The Fed basically started buying both treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities so that anybody who wanted their hands on cash were able to get it by just selling to the Fed. And they bought more. If you look during March and April, they bought more than they did during all of the quantitative easing rounds 1, 2, and 3. It was massive intervention, $70 billion a day pumping into the economy. And it eventually solved the problem, but probably not in a way that anybody thinks is a good way to run a railroad.
And I would add to that, the Fed and other central banks were incredibly aggressive. But one of the government responses that was distinct this time was also the scale and speed of the fiscal support. And that is not something that we can take for granted in response to future crises. So it did make a very big difference that you had Congress providing widespread support. And of course, if you're pumping money into the real economy, that reduces the magnitude of the shock that the financial portion of the economy is going to experience. But that's not something that we can take for granted by any means. And again, we did see real fragilities, even if eventually calmed down.
I think you're arguing in this report that really we should have seen this coming. So why wasn't anyone sounding the alarm before COVID hit?
There were a lot of reports that pointed to some of the problems that emerged. Our group started deliberating in December of 2019, and we identified most of the things that we wrote about in the report then. Before we'd had the real live COVID stress, nobody saw that coming in December when we were talking, but there were various reports by international bodies. There were trade groups that were writing about this. There were academics that were writing about this. Some of it, I think, goes back to the fact that Dodd-Frank was done in haste, and there was a lot of legislation in Dodd-Frank, but it was written very quickly. Before we had a postmortem on the crisis, it focused heavily on banks. A lot of our report focuses on the non-bank parts of the financial system.
This report goes into detail about how the regulatory regime has fallen short and how you correct that. But isn't that a little bit optimistic? Doesn't regulation always lag what's happening in the financial markets? Can you ever create the sort of stability that you're looking for here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the interesting things to point out in terms of language is you're right. Last time it was all about stability. It was trying to create a financial system that would never have vulnerabilities. I think we've moved past that to a language of resilience, a recognition that we're going to have shocks that emanate from within, shocks that emanate from without. And the goal is not to make it so there's never periods of fragility or dysfunction, but those periods are small and can be contained without the scale of interventions that we saw this time. So when we talk about regulatory shortcomings, it's not an idealistic version of regulators being three steps ahead, but rather making them two steps behind instead of 10 steps behind. And really, in particular, when the ways that they are falling short involve threats to potential stability of the entire financial system, which can have macroeconomic consequences, making sure that they have the tools and the incentives that they need to address those types of threats.
So, to the report, your main focus seems to be on the working of the Financial Stability Oversight Council. For people who've forgotten about that, could you explain what it is, what it's for?
So this was one of the Dodd-Frank creations. The U.S. has an extremely fragmented financial regulatory structure. There were two different ways you could respond to that. One is to streamline the number of regulators. And we're very supportive of that. There are a lot of other reports that have already proposed how to do that. The approach taken in Dodd-Frank that we think can be significantly strengthened is rather than streamlining, change the incentives and tools that they have, but making sure that all of those primary regulators, the market regulators, the banking regulators, are also really engaged in understanding how their actions affect the health of the overall financial system, having them work more cooperatively together in those endeavors, and having them also engage in systematic follow-up and constant horizon scanning to try to understand where the deficiencies and weaknesses are and what might be done to address those. FSOC is made up of all of the heads of all of the key financial regulators in the United States. It's overseen by the Treasury Secretary, 10 voting members, 5 non-voting members, and that's the body that we'd like to have slightly modified and meaningfully strengthened.
One of the things that you want to do is you want Congress to clarify that every Financial Stability Oversight Council member has an obligation to promote stability and resilience. Now, guys, considering that stability is in the name of the council, why isn't this not already the case?
I think part of it is you got to go back to what Kate just said, that it's made up of the existing regulators. And these existing regulators have very different traditions. Some of them come from a consumer protection tradition where things like macroeconomy and overall system stability are things that are just not in their job description. And so there have been cases, notable cases, say involving money market funds, where essentially everybody else except the regulator that was in charge of looking after them thought there was a problem. And they would say, look, where in our mandate, the law doesn't tell us to worry about this stuff you're talking about. And so we think that's a cornerstone that's got to be done, that every agency has to take on board. We're all in this together. They all ought to have a little division or an office operating in there that's worried about the overall stability of the system, that looks intensively at the part that they're in charge of, but looks broadly everywhere. And we think that's an important change. It's a very easy technical change to legislate, but it's important.
And if they do commit that they are all in this together, then what difference does that make to the way they work, what they do?
This is where we also have a number of recommendations. We think the legal mandate is necessary, but far from sufficient to bring about the types of changes that we want to see. We also recommend that every FSOC member, so all the financial regulators, have an office that's devoted to resilience and also data collection. So that way you actually institutionalize within each of these agencies, a group of people who have the expertise and the incentives to engage in the type of horizon scanning that you need to understand the systemic ramifications. We also include much more robust processes in terms of reporting, understanding what's going on, what the changes have been, the new emerging threats, either within their domain, within somebody else's domain. And we propose changes to the rulemaking process so that they're engaged in rulemaking that has the potential to have collateral consequences elsewhere in the financial system. They should make some conjectures over what that might look like, and then also follow up 3 or 5 years later to see how accurate those predictions were.
You also recommend that the US should have an undersecretary for financial stability. But in the Treasury, there is already someone who has financial stability as a pretty big part of the day job, and that is the Treasury Secretary. So if you just put a new official in there, what more's going to happen?
I think two things. First of all, the Treasury Secretary has about 4 day jobs, and the amount of time available to her or he is just finite. They don't have enough time to do everything they're expected to do. And there's just no way one person can do all of this. They had a full-time job before the Financial Stability Oversight Council was ever created and all this was dumped onto them. So I think there's a bandwidth issue. The second thing, though, is even if somebody cares desperately, and I think Janet Yellen certainly does. I mean, there's a long paper trail of all the ways in which she signaled she thinks this is important. She just can't stay on it. And if you've got a Treasury Secretary that's well-intentioned and then has somebody that's deputized, recognized in the law as having the authority to keep the process moving along, we just think you'll get much better outcomes. The Treasury Secretary in that case could step in at key junctures, but you'd have somebody driving the bus every day. And if you look at the way regulation works in most central banks and lots of other organizations, there's usually one lead deputy that's in charge of it. So that's how it works at the Fed. That's how it works at most central banks. There's a deputy governor for financial stability. In most finance ministries, there's a lead regulatory person. The Treasury is very unusual, just having 2 people for markets and the economy. So we think there's space to create one more job there.
And finally, you want to close data gaps. So as where are these gaps and how are you going to close them?
The gaps are everywhere. The Treasury market that we started off the conversation with is a nice example. It's an absolutely critical market, both for domestic but also international financial market functioning. And yet there were critical information gaps in terms of who was actually involved in real time, in particular, what the trades were that were causing the degree of dysfunction that we saw. Broadly, one of the key challenges, going back to that fragmented regulatory regime, is you have a bunch of different regulators capturing information for their own purposes, but they're not necessarily communicating either that information or what they're capturing or why with the other regulators. So you have a siloed approach to information. And if you want to understand fragility, what you really need to understand are what are the vectors and interconnections that exist that make it, when you have some dysfunction in one area of the market, it's going to cause dysfunction someplace else. And that's where we really have the gaps that we want to have addressed. And broadly speaking, the way we see doing that is significantly strengthening and somewhat restructuring what had been the Office of Financial Research, another Dodd-Frank creation, into a new comptroller for data and resilience.
We have talked only about the US today. Well, fair enough, because that's what the report's about. But in Europe as well, they're also reassessing the regulatory structure at the moment. Do you think that Europe needs the same kind of reforms as you're recommending for the US?
Well, certainly there are areas of the European architecture that are fragile and fragmented. Data is a great example. A lot of the data goes across borders, and just trying to make a map of the entire financial system and figure out who's selling, who's buying, who's connected to whom if some entity gets into trouble. I mean, look at Archegos as an example. There was no one that was really responsible for doing a deep dive on what happened. Now, it turns out a lot of the central banks are cooperating, and there's going to be hopefully some sort of eyesight into that. But that was a small, tiny little office that shook the system, and somehow nobody saw it coming. And so I think there is room for improvement, not just in the United States, but kind of everywhere. And you know, it's going to take a sustained effort. People have to look beyond their own narrow mandate to try to cooperate and see the bigger picture. And in Europe, where you've got all these different countries, nobody really wants to share all their dirty laundry with the regulator in the next country. So it's tricky. But yes, I think there's room for a lot of the same kinds of improvements in Europe as well.
Well, one thing that is truly international, regulators always look tired. There's a lot of work ahead. Thank you very much, both of you, for talking to me today. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you. We appreciate you making the time.
And Anil, thank you as well.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
So you'll want to have a look at the report. There are loads of authors, so I'm just going to call it Hubbard et al. Of course, two of the al's are Anil and Kate. And it is called Task Force on Financial Stability, published by the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy and the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. If you want to read about this, but you don't want to read a whole report, well, there is an article on VoxEU. It's called Reforming the Macroprudential Regulatory Architecture in the US. Authors Catherine Judge and Anil Kashyap, of course, published on the 21st of July. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you'll be reading in journals 18 months from now, well, listen to Vox Talks Economics Today. And there are literally hundreds of Vox Talks in the archives if you are a subscriber. So have you subscribed yet? If not, why not? You don't want to miss out.